On the program today, trade for a change. Words matter. We'll explain that one. And how many zeros in a trillion anyway? From American Public Media, this is Market Price. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, the 17th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. How long has it been, do you suppose, since we led this program with trade? A while, certainly, after a long, long run of all trade all the time. But we return to it today by noting that the U.S. Trade Representative, Robert Lighthizer by name, spent the better part of this Wednesday on Capitol Hill. Lots to talk about, of course, chief among them, Lighthizer's, and by extension, the Trump administration's overall dissatisfaction with the World Trade Organization and what its rules are about, of course, tariffs. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour is on the trade desk today.
Every country in the WTO has a maximum average tariff that they can stick to their trading partners, and boy, are they different.
The average tariff binding for Brazil is 31%, whereas for the United States, the average is about 3.5%.
Timothy Kehoe is professor of economics at the University of Minnesota. Now, it should be said that just because countries can charge a maximum tariff does not mean they do. Brazil's average real tariff rate is 13%, way below its max of 31. But that still does sound crazy on the face of it, that the rules let some countries tax the stuffing out of their trading partners.
But it's what has been negotiated. You know, I mean, states have signed up to this.
Rachel Brewster is professor of law at Duke. Over the decades, as countries first signed up for the WTO or agreements even before the WTO existed, they were coming from very different places. Some were much more closed economies with crazy high tariffs and others less so. And every entry to the WTO involved a negotiation to bring down those tariffs.
So when we talk about China having 10% bound tariff rates, this is what China negotiated and what the members of the WTO accepted, including the United States.
Now, of course, things change. China's economy has grown more than 900% since 2001, for example. So it's reasonable for countries to disagree over current tariff imbalances. The question is, what do you do about it? Chad Bown is with the Peterson Institute.
Reciprocity. I'll lower my tariffs here, but in exchange, you have to lower your tariffs there.
That's one option. The other option is threats.
The Trump administration's approach thus far has basically been, you'll lower your tariffs, and if you don't, then we're going to raise our tariffs against you.
The results so far have been a mixed bag. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
We have been talking a lot on the program the past couple of weeks about how racism and discrimination is baked into this economy, and how a lot of people are working to change that. And that gets us to the tech industry and its long and well-documented history of not recruiting and training black people. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports now on how the very language of technology plays into that and what some coders are doing about it.
Some of the basic terminology of hardware and software is getting broader scrutiny. Terms like blacklist for malicious websites and whitelist for safe emails. Gabriel Chapo, a senior software engineer at LinkedIn, points to even more troublesome terms.
There's like the software side of things where like master and slave could be referring to a machine that is the main machine, or slave, which would be like the thing that the master controls.
Carla Monteroso is CEO of Code 2040, which works to improve diversity in the tech industry. She says the first time she came across master and slave in coding,
I had a physical reaction to it.
Several tech CEOs, including at networking company Cisco, say they are working on updates, part of efforts to make their companies more inclusive. Monteroso says Black and Latinx people leave tech at 3 times the rate of white men.
And a part of that is the environment that gets created and who is required to experience discomfort during the workplace.
Alexis Moody, a software engineer at data intelligence firm Morning Consult, is working on changing the language there.
Seeing those terms, it just a little cut all the time.
She says it does take time to update the code, but
it's such a minuscule change that pays dividends for inclusion and diversity down the road.
And this idea, changing the language of tech, has been picking up steam among the big players. Both LinkedIn and GitHub, owned by Microsoft, are making changes, and Google has asked developers to use racially neutral language as well. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Kind of mixed on Wall Street today. Not a whole lot of enthusiasm either way. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Over in the UK, much as here, quarantine regulations are being relaxed. But the economic after effects of the pandemic are still piling on, much as here, actually. Most particularly over there, though, in the labor market, something that the Brits are unaccustomed to. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
32-year-old Emma Timberlake worked as an administrator in a small construction firm. The pay was modest, but she says the job was perfect.
The manager was lovely and the operational director was lovely and it was a home from home. You know, it was my forever home.
Forever lasted 5 years. A few weeks into furlough, Emma received a letter just two sentences long telling her that she'd been laid off.
I'm gutted. You know, when you give 5 years of your life and you're passionate about what you do and the clients and customers to have that terminated in two sentences... I was heartbroken. I am heartbroken still.
And shocked by the sudden change in the economic climate. In a country famous for the ease of finding work, Emma has now applied for more than 100 run-of-the-mill jobs without success.
This is very different from the way it has been in this country.
This is the first time that I do not feel optimistic about a possible job prospect. So, yeah... This is not looking good. This is not looking good.
Self-confidence is the first casualty of unemployment. Staying fit is vital.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to day number one of my 30-minute workout.
In a bid to keep her spirits up, 35-year-old Char Melanie, who lost her marketing job in March, spends an hour a day following an online exercise class.
Knees up. 10 seconds.
She does voluntary work for a local charity too, but she admits the fruitless, dispiriting search for a job is getting her down.
It's actually quite terrifying now that I apply and it just seems that applications just go into a black hole. It's just silence. Nothing.
Sian lives with her boyfriend, who's still working, but as an independent young woman, she's determined to pay her way and is dipping into her savings. Unemployment, a totally new experience, is taking its toll.
It's kind of big black cloud over me that I'm not earning, and we're now coming into the third month, and how many more months is it going to be? I've never not had a job. I love to work. Yeah, I really do.
The lockdown has already cost at least 1 million British jobs. When the furlough scheme winds down and the government stops paying the wages of more than 8 million workers, there are likely to be many more unemployed. But lockdown has not been universally negative. In her living room, painter Cece Phillips sets up her easel and puts the finishing touches to one of her vivid portraits. Cece had been working from home for her ad agency employer, but she decided to quit that job and launch herself as a full-time artist.
Obviously, the pandemic is awful and lockdown has caused just a huge strain on everyone's lives, but I did also see it as an opportunity to do art.
So far, the gamble has paid off. Her canvases are selling briskly, and she has 6 months' worth of commissions.
Lockdown presented me with the opportunity to build up my work and follow my passion and really commit to doing something that I'd always been too scared or hesitant to do.
But Cece is an exception. For millions of Brits, lockdown will probably not prove a springboard. A leading recruitment agency predicts that by the fall, unemployment could hit 15%, the worst level of joblessness here since the Great Depression. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Last week, the state of California and the county of Los Angeles let movie and television production start up again. One of the first scripted dramas to turn on the cameras will be the CBS daytime soap The Bold and the Beautiful. There will be coronavirus restrictions in place, of course. And as Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports, that is going to mean a lot of stony, silent glares, secret lovers, and social distancing.
Like most TV shows, The Bold and the Beautiful ended production in mid-March because of COVID-19. Now it's going to start taping again, but steamy scenes like this?
When you said that you wanted to paint me, I thought that you meant that you wanted to paint me.
Some actors might film intimate scenes with their real-life partners, and the show will be deploying old soap opera tricks like panning to the fireplace during a romantic scene. Duncan Crabtree Ireland, the COO of the Screen Actors Union, SAG-AFTRA, says everyone wants to get back to work, but
our members are going to have to work without any kind of protective equipment. They're going to have to work in close physical proximity. They won't be able to observe physical distancing all the time.
For weeks, he's been discussing how to reopen with epidemiologists, including Ian Lipkin from Columbia University. He says the most important thing is going to be testing.
If you tested people before they joined a production and you continue to test them once a week, you can dramatically reduce the risk.
It's key that everyone on set understand that keeping healthy is a collective responsibility, says Baruch Fishhoff, a behavioral psychologist with Carnegie Mellon University, who also helped develop Hollywood's reopening guidelines.
If somebody, you know, gets it wrong and there are some tragedies in part of the set, everybody will pay the price.
For now, The Bold and the Beautiful is one of the first to venture boldly into the new Hollywood. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Hello, I'm here to pick up chickens.
Come on in. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials down 170 points today, 0.6%, closed at 26,119. The NASDAQ added 14 points, about a 10%, 99.10. The S&P 500 dipped 11.3%, ended things at 31.13. Southwest Airlines down 0.7% today. The company announced it's going to limit ticket sales to two-thirds capacity through the end of September. Open seating, of course, in the middle row there, which is nice. Elsewhere in the air, other carriers pulled back after a couple of days of gains. United down 2.3%, Delta down 1.8% on the day. Hey, let's go to the mattresses, shall we? Tempur Sealy firmed up 5.1% today. The mattress seller said orders in its current quarter are better than expected so far. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 0.73%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are, by the latest tallies, something more than $3.5 trillion into the government's economic rescue plan, with probably more on the way. So with the congressional price tag for this economic crisis headed deeper into the 13 digits, that is what trillions looks like, we're going to do a bit of a big picture primer here on government spending on the program over the next couple of days and why it matters long term and short. First thing to remember is that whenever you talk about debt, you got to talk about another word, too.
The deficit,
which is
the excess of the amount you're spending this year over the amount that you're taking in.
That's Valerie Ramey. She teaches economics at the University of California, San Diego. The government spends money every year on things like Social Security and the military. And this year, those coronavirus rescue packages we were talking about a couple of seconds ago. The deficit is the difference between what we spend annually and what we take in, mostly through taxes. as of its latest estimates, the Congressional Budget Office figures the coronavirus legislation has increased the deficit this year from around $1 trillion to about $3.7 trillion. One single year, that is, of revenues minus spending.
Every time they spend more than they take in, that just adds up to their debt.
Their debt, our national debt, actually, is well over $26 trillion right now.
And if they keep doing it year after year as they have, the amount of debt, which means the total amount that they owe people, keeps growing over time.
Till eventually?
The last time we had debt levels that high were at the end of World War II.
The national debt is so big now in part because of spending increases in times of crisis like this one, but also because of other fiscal policy decisions that Congress and the White House have made, the GOP's $1 trillion debt finance tax cut being the most recent example. The catch, of course, is that if you don't have the money, you got to borrow the money, which is what we have been doing for decades.
What they're doing is floating more government bonds. So basically, they're taking out loans is a way to think about it.
So tomorrow on the program, those loans and part two of debt and deficit and this economy. How come people keep lending us so much money? Pop culture is, as much as anything is, an economic intangible. And like a lot of really tangible economic things, pop culture is exportable. We do it. A lot of other countries do it as well. Japan, for one example. From Mario to Hello Kitty, our pop culture has been suffused with decades of imports from Japan. But the effect goes deeper than just stuff that we buy. Matt Alt is a writer. He's a translator as well. He's been living in Japan for a couple of decades now, and he's got a book out next week. It's called Pure Invention, How Japan's Pop Culture Conquered the World. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
First of all, would you talk to me about this group of, you call them super fans in your book. There is a Japanese word, which I will certainly mispronounce, so I'm going to let you do it. But they bear some special mention in this story.
Otaku. The word is otaku. And yes, they're super fans, but more than that, they're hyper connoisseurs. They're people who kind of defined themselves and built their identities through the things they consumed. And the things they consumed were things that grown-ups didn't really like very much, like comic books and cartoons and things like that. Now, in the 80s, this was really, really transgressive behavior in Japan or really anywhere else. But the funny thing is now, adults consuming kid culture has become the de facto standard all around the world, whether it's watching Marvel movies or whether it's, you know, consuming fun food fads like cupcakes.
You took this to an extension that I need you to walk me through. You call otaku, these super fans, you call them canaries in the coal mine for late stage capitalism. Help me out with that.
Yes. So what happened was when Japan was this incandescent economic superpower, everything was fine. But once the economy crashed and ushered in the lost decades, a period for Japanese people began that's really akin to our post-Great Recession. And what happened was as young people's dreams are basically taken away from them, their promises of employment at big firms, of social safety nets that the previous generation had, they were basically left to their own devices to figure out how to make their way through this really, quite frankly, depressing new world. And to do that, they turned to the things that they loved. And otaku, who identified themselves through the things that they bought, became this new force in the Japanese economy. They were basically the last people standing.
Okay, so my guess would be that this book went to publication before you had a chance to include the events of the last 90 days, but is there a corollary of the otaku as canaries in the coal mine of late-stage capitalism to what we're going through right now?
Well, actually, the book does go up right until lockdown in March of this year. But yes, you know, as we were forced to all kind of cocoon inside, as we were forced to become as what Japanese call almost like hikikomori, which is a Japanese word for people who stay inside and do nothing but consume their own hobbies because they're afraid to go out, the tools that those sorts of people developed in their lost decades in Japan started to become the things that we use to make it through our own lockdowns and our own economic dystopia in the West. Whether it be sitting in front of Netflix and watching shows that we love over and over again, or forming really strong fan identities, whether you're an Iron Man fan or a Batman fan or what have you, even as an adult. These are tools of a sort that were developed in a relatively horrific economic period in Japan, and they proved to be very useful or relevant for people in a similar situation abroad.
There is a stylistic thing that I think bears mention here, and it's anime, and it's Hello Kitty, and it's what you brought vividly to life for me, the marches in Washington after the Trump inauguration and those pussy hats. Those were all of a piece.
Yes. Well, you know, Hello Kitty is a really interesting thing in and of itself because it started as this basically decoration to sell stationery to little girls in Japan. But over the next 20 to 30 years, it developed into this symbol of feminine power, that you could be cute and that you could be strong at the same time. And Krista Saw, who invented the co-creator of those pussy hats, actually told me that she spent a lot of time in Sanrio shops as a kid. So the impact and the effect of these things goes far beyond them being simple hit products. They really transformed our fantasies and profoundly affected our realities in the process.
Matt Ault, we got him in Tokyo. Where he lives and works. His latest book is called Pure Invention, How Japan's Pop Culture Conquered the World. Matt, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's not out till next week, but we've got an excerpt of Matt's book that you can read right now. Marketplace.org is where you'll find it. Here's today's entry for the, man, I learned something every day in this job file. Turns out back in March and April, chick hatcheries across the country started seeing a bunch of new orders. Some were pandemic inspired. People apparently worried they wouldn't be able to get enough eggs. Others were ranchers just looking to re-up their stock. Either way, the deliveries are happening now. Marfa Public Radio's Carlos Morales checks in with a couple of chick parents.
Lisa Katile first placed her order for some backyard chicks in late March. 2 months later, she's picking them up at the post office.
Hello, I'm here to pick up chickens.
I talked to Katile there from a safe distance. She's had chicks growing up in Pennsylvania and later on in life, and ever since she moved to Marfa, she's wanted to have some in the rural West Texas desert.
Okay, we're opening the chicken box.
In Texas's Big Bend region, where Katile lives, the large chick supplier said they were completely sold out. But she was able to buy some for her and a few others from a supplier in New Mexico. $166 for 37 chicks. While she waited for them to arrive, she put together a brooder, got a heat lamp to keep her chicks warm, and all the feed she needed.
So yeah, there's a ton of stuff that you have to do. Plus, we would have built a chicken coop from scratch, but we had an old shed in our backyard, and so we just remodeled the shed into the Fort Knox of chicken coops.
Server. Just down the street, 82-year-old Herb Serber is hearing from new chick owners like Katile.
Constantly. They call me all the time.
I met Serber at his supply and feed store in Marfa, which he's run for decades. He tells me first-time chick buyers usually need some extra help.
Some will come back in here later and say, can you give me advice on how to raise these chickens?
He says that chicks can take a lot of work.
No one kind of prepares you for this?
In the age of new chick owners, Douglas Friedman is a bit of a pro at just 3 months. His chicken ranch, as he calls it, sits on a dusty hill just outside Marfa city limits.
This is a Polish crested chicken, and they're very, very friendly and sweet little animals. They're almost like cats or dogs.
Friedman doesn't have much work right now, and he was stuck at home because of shelter-in-place orders, so he decided to raise chickens with his neighbor. He's got about 25, and they all roost in a coop he's dubbed the best little hen house in Texas on the Instagram account he started for it.
What was so helpful about that Instagram page was that people that knew about chickens and chicken coops, they were all so generous with their knowledge.
Through chicken Instagram, Friedman learned a few things, like how to prevent common health risks for chicks and how to take care of his coop. The chicks have provided some routine for his day-to-day life now. No eggs just yet. That won't happen until the chicks mature into hens another few months. In Marfa, Texas, I'm Carlos Morales for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. You know, sometimes Fed Chair Jay Powell's congressional testimony, well, it's dry, right? Kind of high concept, very macroeconomic. And sometimes it's, that was interesting. Today was one of those. Turns out this economy is kind of running out of coins in circulation. In response to a question, Powell said, and this is a quote, "What happened is, with the partial closure of the economy, the flow of coins through the economy has kind of stopped. The places where you'd go to give your coins and get credit, those have not been working." End of quote. Like I said, kind of interesting, right? All right, here is your moment of historical economic context on this, Wednesday? And I bring it to you because I'm a history guy. I think I've said that. 90 years ago today, maybe the most misguided trade law ever was signed. Anyone? 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 Smoot Hawley, come on. Our media production team is Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. They are going into the studios so that the rest of us don't have to. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And oh yeah, this is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.